Thank you. And now, Pastor Comparé.
Tonight I want to talk to you about something that is becoming important in the day's news gradually as the things are building up to the climax at the end. What God called his vengeance upon Edom. Now, you remember that Esau and Jacob were twins. They started, therefore, with exactly the same heredity. And, in fact, Esau, as the firstborn, would have been entitled to the birthright. It meant that he got a double share of whatever property could be inherited from his father, and it also meant that he became, in his turn, the family patriarch, with all the authority that went with that. And yet, he threw it away. Now, you read, of course, in the Bible, how he was out hunting and came in tired, and Jacob had cooked up a lentil stew. And Esau asked for a bowl of it, and Jacob said, well, sell me your birthright for it. And Esau said, oh, what good does this birthright do to me? I'm starving. Sure, I'll sell you my birthright for this bowl of stew. Now, that was not when he parted with his birthright. That was nothing more than a formal ceremony of acknowledgement of the fact that he had lost it before. Now you remember that all the way down the line, God had been careful to keep the race line pure. And Esau violated that. Before this formal sale of his birthright, he had married two Hittite wives. Now, from the beginning, God made it very clear that the race line had to be kept pure. If the various pre-Adamite races had been capable of doing the job that God wanted done, he would not have gone to the trouble of creating a new, entirely different being, Adam. You remember that when it came time to provide Adam with a wife, in the Hebrew, it says that God wanted him to have a helpmate as his counterpart, his equal in every respect. Now, if he had married a negress, she could only bear him mulatto children. If he married a Mongolian woman, she could only bear him Eurasian children. She would not be his counterpart. Adam had to have a wife who would bear him children who would be of the same line as himself, with the same qualities for which God specially created him. And all the way down, God had insisted on preserving the purity of the race line. Now, in the case of Noah, out of the 27,000 odd times that your King James Version garbles up and botches things, it does when it talks about Noah as being perfect in his generations, which is a meaningless term. What it says in the Hebrew is that he was perfect in his ancestry or descent, not mongrelized. The people around him, the others who were of Adamite blood originally, had mongrelized with the surrounding races. They had destroyed the possibility that they could do God's work, and yet they were becoming numerous enough that this mongrelized group could become a menace. So God disposed of them with the flood. Now, all this had been taught generation after generation, and yet when it came down to Esau, he married two Hittite wives. Now, all the ancient monuments that show pictures of Hittites, including the carvings on the walls of some of the old Hittite palaces that have been excavated, So it's not their enemy's caricature of them. It's their own picture of themselves. Show them as typical hook-nosed Jews. And Esau married two of those. His descendants could only be mongrels. There was when he forfeited the birthright. He could not become the patriarch to carry on the line. So, the Bible tells you that from the time he sold his birthright, which he'd already forfeited. You know, today when somebody sells something he doesn't own, we call that obtaining money under false pretenses, and we put him in jail for it. Well, actually, that's what Esau did. He no longer had anything to sell. From that time on, his name was called Edom, meaning red. See Genesis 25, verses 30 to 34. Actually, the conflict really started even before their birth. In Genesis 25, verses 22 and 23, we read that while these twins were still in their mother's womb, they fought and scuffled together. And their mother, wondering what this could be, in prayer asked God to give her the explanation. And she was told, two nations are in thy womb. That they would have very different destinies. Now you remember also, of course, that Jacob intended to give the blessing to Esau. Now Jacob, whose name had been changed to Israel, was, after all, not too admirable a character. He had some faults of his own. Isaac, I should say, wanted to give the birthright to Esau. His mother, however, saw that anybody who was mongrelized with these Canaanites was not a proper one to have the birthright. She said that these daughters of Heth are making my life miserable. So she arranged for the little deceit to be put over on Isaac, that Jacob impersonated Esau and received the blessing. Well, when Esau came in a bit later and asked for the blessing and was told, well, it's too late, I've already given it to your brother, and he shall be blessed. Now, there was a recognition that that blessing couldn't be taken from him. Now, actually, the deceit practiced by Jacob was not what did it. While these twins were still in their mother's womb, and as I say, she asked God what the explanation was of their scuffling and struggling together, God said, two nations are in thy womb, and the elder shall serve the younger. Now Esau, the firstborn, the elder, was nevertheless, by orders of God himself, to be assigned an inferior place. Not that this was arbitrary favoritism. God was able to see the character that they both had. Now, as I say, Jacob had his faults, but he did at least preserve the pure race line. Esau would have thrown it all away. Esau was nevertheless given a blessing. He was told, thy dwelling shall be the fatness of the earth, and by thy sword shalt thou live. That's Genesis 27, verses 39 to 40. And back in the ancient times, the Edomites, the descendants of Esau, were indeed a warlike people. Unlike their descendants of recent times, they did their own fighting instead of involving the Christian peoples in wars to do the fighting for them. Well, during the latter years of Isaac's life, while Jacob was away with Laban, you remember how he went to Laban to get a wife, a daughter of Laban, and had to work so many years for his wives there. Esau moved out of the promised land, Palestine. He moved down to Mount Seir. That word Seir means rugged. And if you've ever seen any pictures of that range, you'll understand why they called it rugged. The Jordan Valley is a deep, narrow trench, only a very few miles wide. Opposite Jerusalem, where the Dead Sea is, it has gotten down so low that the surface of the Dead Sea is 1,340 feet below sea level. Now, it's running down, of course, from where the Jordan River starts, up in the north, up in the Lebanese mountains, and it has to rise again from there south to get above sea level, otherwise the Red Sea would flow into it. So the continuation of the Jordan Valley, called the Wadi Araba, goes on down to the Gulf of Aqaba, but of course it rises to points above sea level. Now the mountains constituting the easterly side of the Wadi Araba, in other words, southeast of the Dead Sea, that's Mount Seir. Sometime in ages past, a terrific earthquake just cracked that mountain. About the center of it, running lengthwise of it, there's an oval valley, which from pictures of it I should judge would be about a mile wide and a mile and a half or mile and three quarters long, running lengthwise of it. And the way the range was cracked, it leads from the outside running into this interior valley, a narrow crevice where it just simply been broken apart like that. The walls are sheer cliffs rising from 400 to 600 feet high. And, there are a couple of places where it widens out to perhaps 15 or 20 feet. But there are many places where a man could stand in the middle and touch the two walls with his outstretched arms. So it makes a natural fortress of this. An army of 1 million men could only come one man at a time. So that the forces guarding this had a marvelous fortress. If the enemy were to undertake to climb over and get down into the valley other ways, that was a terrific job. And for many centuries, nobody succeeded in doing it. So, in this crevice in the little narrow valley, lies the ancient city of Petra. You have heard something about it. You may have seen pictures of it in National Geographic. Now, there's a strange thing about it. This crack that goes from the outside into the center of the mountain range is like the stem of a capital T. There's another crack forming the crossbar of the T, running a little way to one side, and the other running through the center of the mountain, parallel to the mountain, into this open valley of Petra. Now, there is only one building that we have any trace of that was built in this valley of Petra the way other people built buildings out in the open. And that was built, I think the 1st or 2nd century A.D. A king of Petra down there had married an Egyptian princess, and he built this as a palace for her, and there's some ruins of it still standing. Now, the rest of these buildings were carved into these sheer cliffs. They're magnificently beautiful. Naturally, there were no back or side windows, so aside from mere storage closets, they're one room deep only. And the most magnificently beautiful architecture on the outside. With one exception, they are 2 stories tall. And the peculiar thing is that those two stories range from 110 to 140 feet high. The old height limit buildings in Los Angeles were 130 feet. Now, the average doorway in Petra, from the floor to the lintel across the top, is 30 feet high. We know how they made the doors in those days, and in fact, there's still traces of it in the stone. At the hinge end of the door, it wasn't hung on ball-bearing hinges like we have today, but there was a vertical post, slightly longer than the door, the ends of which were rounded, sheathed with bronze, and then in the stone, there was a cup-shaped depression, also sheathed with bronze, and those made the two pivot points on which the door could swing. It would be impossible for any man living today to have strength enough to open or close one of those doors. Neither would he need one 30 feet high. Now, there's one type of archaeologist, you know, who views everything as a tomb, and according to them, nobody lived in Petra but the dead. All these buildings are classified as tombs. The architecture in itself is a complete refutation of any such idea. I said there was one exception to this two-story thing. There is one building in the opening this valley. Everywhere along this entrance crevice, of course, they had the vertical cliffs already to carve their buildings into it. When they got into the wider valley, the sides sloped down into it. So they would cut these back until they had left a vertical cliff of the height they wanted. And there was one building where the vertical cliff extended high enough for two stories, and they built a little false front wall sticking up in the air above that to give it the appearance of three stories. But it was not a true three-story building. Now, how come all these huge buildings? Well, Genesis 6, verse 4, botched up in your King James Version, of course, tells you there were giants in the earth in those days. However, in the Hebrew, it says there were the Nephilim in the earth in those days. And also after that, when the sons of God came in unto the daughters of men, and they bore children to them, the same became mighty men, which were of old, the men of renown. Now, that Hebrew word Nephilim means the fallen ones. And you remember from the beginning the rebel angels who followed Satan and were cast out of heaven to the earth have always been called the fallen angels. And that's the only people to whom this term, the fallen ones, has ever been applied. Now, their descendants were, for a time, giants indeed. This infusion of angelic blood was sufficient to produce these giants. Now, any animal breeder, whether he's breeding goldfish or dogs or what, can tell you that the hardest job he has is to prevent any pure breed that he has from going back to the original strain, the average that we call normal. Your dogs, of course, started with jackals and that sort of thing, or the Australian wild dog, the dingo. And if you don't keep your breeds pure by weeding out those that tend to breed back to that original type, you will get back to what we started with centuries ago before breeders patiently produced the kind they wanted. The same is true of goldfish. They're a carp whose natural color is a slate gray. And unless you keep eliminating from your goldfish tank any that show some mottlings of slate gray, you aren't going to have any goldfish after a generation or two, because they will have bred back to what they started to. So, over a period of many years, these giants apparently bred back to a more or less normal human size. There are in Africa today certain tribes whose average height is over 7 feet. So, they could be fairly big, but not entirely out of the normal human type. So, of these descendants of these fallen angels, there were the Anakim, the children of Anak, son of Arba, a descendant of Heth. They lived in Palestine. You remember when the children of Israel on the Exodus were ready to enter the promised land, and they sent some spies in to see what it was like. And they came back terrified. They said, "And there we saw the giants, the sons of Anak, which come of the giants. And we were in our sight as grasshoppers, and so we were in their sight." So even in 1486 B.C., you had some of them living in Palestine. Then you had the Emim, the terrible ones, who lived east of the Dead Sea, over in the territory of Ammon. It's east and north of the Dead Sea. Genesis 14, verse 5, and Deuteronomy 2, verses 10 and 11. Then there were the Zuzim, which means wild beasts or giants. They lived northeast of the Dead Sea in the land of Ammon. That's Genesis 14, verse 5. Now, south of that, east of the Dead Sea, and there were some of them in Palestine too, were the Amorites. And they again were a rather gigantic people. Deuteronomy 1, verse 44, speaks of this, and Amos 2, verse 9, mentions the Amorite, whose height was like the height of the cedars, which is no doubt an exaggeration, but they were impressively big people. Then, near Jerusalem, as well as across the Jordan to the east, were the Rephaim. Your Bible spells it R-E-P-H-A-I-M, but the Hebrew is Rephaim. Now, the basic word implies enormous strength, but there is also something about it that has caused it to be translated in places as ghosts or dead things. Then, in Mount Seir, were the Horim, the cave dwellers. They were the ones who would cut these gigantic buildings into the sides of the cliff. They were related to the Rephaim and the Emim. Now, these Horites were the descendants of one called Seir. Now, into this area moved Esau with his two Canaanite wives. Now, already, his children, the first descendants, were mongrels, half Canaanite. And whom could his children marry? Suppose, for example, that a white man married two negresses, moved to the interior of the Congo, and for 1,800 years his descendants lived there and had nobody to marry except the native Congolese around him. After 1,800 years, what would his descendants be? They'd be as negroid as any of the people around them. And yet they could say, 18 centuries ago, we had a white ancestor, couldn't they? We'll come to that when we get to studying what these people claim to Jesus Christ. Well, a Horite woman, Timna, was a concubine to Esau's son, Eliphaz. And his son by her was Amalek. And you remember how pestiferous all the Amalekites, his descendants, were. See Genesis 36, verses 12 and 20 to 22. Now, aside from what the ordinary Canaanites in Palestine may have been, the Hittites, the Hivites, the Perizzites, the Jebusites, and so on, here, definitely, a satanic bloodline entered into the Edomites, because they were marrying into a line of those descended from these fallen angels, the Raphaim. Now, you find references to this city of Petra in places in the Bible. As I say, it was the most magnificent natural fortress in the world. Toward the north end of this valley, there was a hill, which was the citadel, the final fortress to which they could retreat in case enemies penetrated into the valley. The Arabs call it el-Biara. It is a roughly round hill, but its walls are sheer cliffs. This mass rises hundreds of feet out of the floor of the valley with these cliffs. Now, there are a few places where it is rough and rugged enough that somebody could climb up these cliffs. But remember, there were no guns in those days. And anybody could gather himself an armload of cobblestones and stand at the head of one of these places, and if anybody tried to climb up, he'd stop them. There was one way only to get to the top. They had carved one path. Most of the way, this path, 2 to 3 feet wide, led along the cliff. In other words, you had on the one side a sheer wall rising above you, and on the other side, hundreds of feet of sheer drop-off. One man could stand there and guard it. And then there was a place or two where it turned farther inland. Instead of going around some projecting rib of rock, it would turn inland. And there it had been cut through the stone, so you had perhaps a 24 to 30 inch wide passage where again one man could guard it. A remarkable fortress. Well, the Edomites in here, after all, Esau had been told that you will live by your sword, and they were pretty chesty about it. Now, it was a natural crossroad of caravan routes. So they, you know, like the mafia, for so much they'll grant protection to a merchant, protection from themselves. And that's what they did there. Every caravan passing by had to pay tribute to them, or else they took the whole thing. And who can stop us in this natural fortress of ours? So Numbers 24, verse 21 speaks of them. Strong is thy dwelling place, and thou puttest thy nest in a rock. Psalm 60, verse 9, and Psalm 108, verse 10. Both refer to the same thing. Who will bring me into the strong city? Who will lead me into Edom? But Jeremiah 49, verses 16 to 17, tells how God was beginning to get impatient with this thing. Thy terribleness hath deceived thee, and the pride of thine heart, O thou that dwellest in the clefts of the rock, that holdest the height of the hill, though thou shouldst make thy nest as high as the eagle, I will bring thee down from thence, saith Yahweh. Also, Edom shall be a desolation. Well, you remember, of course, how Esau hated his brother Israel. Esau was unwilling to accept the responsibilities of the birthright, but he wanted the benefit of it. And when he lost the benefit, there was bitter hatred there. He planned to kill his brother Jacob, That's why he was sent away to Laban to live and get a wife there. So, in the later period here, when the Israelites were coming out of Egypt in the Exodus, you had Esau's original hatred of Egypt, of Israel, and now multiplied by the satanic hatred of Israel. And there was never any relenting in that. Numbers 20, verses 14 to 21 tells how the natural way into the promised land would have taken them up this Wadi Araba through the territory ruled by the Edomites. Not into their fortress valley, but in the territory outside, which they ruled and levied on every passing caravan. And the Israelites asked permission. This is under Moses. Asked permission to peaceably pass through. They said, "We won't let our cattle eat in your fields, your pastures. We'll stay right on the highway. We just ask permission to go through." And they were refused with threats of war. In fact, the Amalekites came out and attacked Israel without cause. And, with the help of God, Israel's army under Joshua defeated the Amalekites. That's Exodus 17, verses 8 to 13. Now for this utterly causeless attack, this war of aggression, God said, "I will utterly put out the remembrance of Amalek from under heaven, because the Lord hath sworn that the Lord will have war with Amalek from generation to generation." Exodus 17, verses 14 to 16. Well, what Moses and Joshua were leading, remember, was a group of fugitive slaves, a disorganized rabble. It had been so long since they had been independent people accustomed to defending themselves that they weren't ready to face war at this time. So, they had to detour around it. They passed around to the south of Mount Seir, around the east side, went up around there, and finally came back into the Jordan Valley above it, above the Dead Sea. Now, near Petra, on this mountain range, is the mountain where Aaron died. The Arabs to this day call it Jebel Harun, the Mount of Aaron. So, the people of Israel finally got into their promised land. You remember that the original promised land was west of the Jordan, between the Jordan and the sea. But the tribes of Reuben and Gad and half the tribe of Manasseh asked that they be given the old lands of Ammon and Moab east of the Jordan. They had great herds of cattle and sheep, and this was fine pasture land. And so they were allowed to remain there. So, to the south and southeast of them remained the Edomites. And there was friction, constant friction there. Well, the Israelites repeatedly conquered the Edomites in battle and drove them off and left them alive. And as repeatedly, the Edomites waited till they could reorganize and came back and attacked them again. Now, you remember the first king of Israel was Saul. And Saul was given instruction to absolutely exterminate these Amalekites. And he didn't. He defeated their army with considerable slaughter, stole their sheep and cattle, and came back well satisfied with himself. And the prophet Samuel told him for this, that for this disobedience, God had deposed him as king. This was the first test that Saul was put to. Would he obey God or wouldn't he? And he failed. See 1 Samuel 15th chapter. Well, part of the blessing that Isaac had given to Esau, by thy sword shalt thou live, and shalt serve thy brother. And it shall come to pass, when thou shalt have the dominion, that thou shalt break his yoke from off thy neck. So you have this seesaw period here of the Edomites attacking, being defeated, reduced to paying tribute for a bit, and then rebelling and regaining their independence. Now, even David did no better than Saul. 2 Samuel 8, verse 14 shows how these Edomites had been conquered and put under a tribute tax by David. But they revolted against Jehoram, king of Judah, about 885 B.C. So here were this mongrel, pestilential people with a satanic bloodline, a constant cause of trouble for God's people Israel. Well, as you know, of course, the Israelites got themselves into trouble, too, by their own misdeeds. The northern 10-tribe kingdom of Israel was conquered by the Assyrians between 740 and 721 B.C. and deported and settled around the southerly end of the Caspian Sea, where they became known as the Scythians. The southerly two-tribed kingdom of Judah still remained in the land for more than a century. Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, came in and conquered the southern kingdom of Judah the first time, about 606 B.C. Now, at that time, he deported to Babylon those that he thought might be ringleaders of revolt. In other words, all the natural leaders, but he didn't take most of the population. Just those that he thought might be troublesome if they were left there. And he left a puppet king, supposed to rule it as a tributary to Babylon. And in the 580s, relying on help from Egypt, they revolted again. So that 585 B.C., Nebuchadnezzar came back and in a long and terrible siege, conquered Jerusalem again, and destroyed the city, and deported substantially all the population. What he left behind were these Canaanite peoples, who had lived in the land all the time and whom the Israelites and Judahites had never exterminated as God had told them to do. Now, at the siege of Jerusalem, when the city was finally taken, plundered, and then burned by the Babylonians, here these Edomites came up and joined in the attack on the city.